America, real sex.
Okay. One day we were given some salt fish and we had to go right up the top of the camp to salt it out. And I can't remember whether I sort of helped myself to some up there or whether it was when we got back to the cookhouse, but I do know looking at it, and there were all these maggots lined up on one side. They were dead because it was salted, but one ate the other bit and left the maggots. But, I suppose it's surprising what one will eat when hungry. Religious holidays, Christmas, Easter and Thanksgiving for the Americans, as well as their holidays such as May Day and October Revolution, we were always given extra. And they really went to town on the grub steaks, always more than you could eat. And you had pork, chicken, beer, and sake, the rice wine. And the Turks, they were given oxen because being Muslims, they didn't eat pork. And they used to have a lot of chickens and that sort of thing. Basically, again, we felt they did what they could for us. And one other thing they always gave us, and even from very early days, was regular supplies of salt. Whilst it was grubby and looked like small grit, one sort of crunched it up a bit more with a couple of spoons and used it. Didn't think too much of whether it was dirty. I don't suppose there were any bugs in it. When the river got frozen in the winters and barges couldn't bring the rations in, they used to bring them on ox sleds or trucks. And we'd heard occasions of when the stuff didn't arrive. If I can remember, it used to come pretty regular, sort of perhaps the same day each week or fortnight, and they said there'd been an accident and some of it had gone in. So, it all helped to make life a bit more bearable. Get back to these Turks. All the British were reasonably fit and kept themselves. There were a few that gave up, but the Turks, they seemed to be able to withstand the early hardships better than anybody else, and we only used to assume that it was because they had a tougher way of life in Turkey. But I cannot remember, although we didn't have a lot to do with them, of seeing any Turks die through, give up itis, as one mentioned, sort of thing.
How did the Chinese get on with trying to influence the Turks politically?
Well, we said he was a white Russian. They did have a European-looking guy there to lecture them in the political lectures. And I don't think anybody ever spoke to him from one could or not. I don't know if anybody ever tried, really. But, he looked sort of Russian, and presumably he could speak Turkish. He definitely wasn't a Turkish-looking Chinese or anything like that, but, more Western European then.
But we sometimes read that the Turks were particularly resistant to communist ideas. Is that true?
I think probably they were. But again, it may have been just the odd individual. When one gets perhaps in a crowd, you go with the sheep, don't you? Really, you'll always find the one who will sort of try and kick the system. To be honest, I couldn't say, but they had their lectures as well as we. This wood stuff, that used to come regularly by barge and was weighed, to how many men occupied your hut and that sort of thing. There was also stockpiled during the summer, and we were taken up into the hills, sort of beyond the town, to collect firewood and, say, stockpile it for the winter. It was mostly brush, sort of small oak and that sort of thing, a bit of ash, etc. Sometimes you'd go up for the individual huts for the prisoners, sometimes you'd go up entirely for the cookhouse. And it was always something extra to do, something that one perhaps looked forward to because it got you out and about and you could see the different countryside and you were going through the house, through the town rather. And I think the other chaps will verify it, but there was rather a very pretty Korean girl who used to live in the first house on the left outside the gate, and of course there's always lots of whistles and that sort of thing. But you would go out of the camp, shall we say, for 2 miles, and then they'd send you up into the hills to get the wood, and then next time you would perhaps go to the same place, and then after that you'd go a bit further, and you gradually get further and further away from the camp, and there used to be a cutting. You could see it through the mountains, sort of thing. They called them mountains, I suppose they were, but they're not mountains as we think of the Alps or Ben Nevis or anything. And we often used to say, well, I wonder what's on the other side there. And, oh, it must have been a 12 months or more, I think, before we got there. And we did get up there, and on the other side there were just still more mountains, so we nearly never found out what was beyond the mountains, sort of thing. They just seemed to go on and on and on. They helped to relieve the boredom, these wood details. When the river was frozen, we used to go across the ice. Some bright spark says, where's the bloody lot goes? Another one says, well, run like the clappers. Another one suggested that we all run in different directions, but it never did break. It used to creak and groan a lot, and I'm not sure whether it was the summer or the winter, but if you can see pictures of the river, there was quite a drop in the water level from one period of the year to the other, and perhaps as much as 20 feet, something like that. We used to walk along singing, well, obviously, I suppose, the Chinese national anthem, and we used to put our own words to it as to who flung dung at Mao Zedong, the students of Pyeongtong. Chaps at the head of the wood detail would get too far ahead of the main party, because some of them used to drag their feet, and it often used to cause a laugh, because the Chinese guards had to run to catch up with us, and, you know, we used to sort of do it a bit more often, really, to keep them going. They used to call us to stop. Well, we gathered that's what they wanted, but we never used to. But, some of the blokes cried off firewood. You know, I suppose they thought, well, I don't want to do that sort of thing. I'd much rather stay here. And they were saying, the only way you could get off it was saying you were sick, something like that. And they never really used to do too much, but most of them fell in line. But it wasn't long before the Mexicans, they were part of the American army, and they used to smoke the old marijuana. Well, they found it growing up there on the hills. And of course then, those who smoked, I suppose they thought, well, they'd try, and there's a mass exodus of smokers to go up into the hills to find this marijuana. And they used to find it, but I mean, it was, what shall I say, frowned on by the Chinese. They didn't like it at all, and there were many lectures about it. But they found the leaves. It looked a bit like stinging nettles. And they used to gather them up and dry them and mix with the tobacco, I suppose, according to how much high they wanted to get. I can remember several of the chaps being on it and being what one would say would be well away. But they never used to get aggressive with it. They used to call it the giggling weed, because there was a lot of laughing and sort of silly nonsense. That sort of... The Chinese, they used to give us a lecture when they followed, and they didn't like it. But it was a good bartering system. So those who perhaps didn't smoke or didn't smoke so much used to get it and keep it and, you know, swap it over with others who did. It went for money, I suppose. Another time, one night, I suppose it must have been in the rainy season, which perhaps would be September, we woke up to find the river had risen. Goodness knows really why, but there was water lapping at the front door. And the British were way down by the river, and we had to get out, and I suppose it had risen about 30 or 40 feet. And next day, three foot deep in water. So they moved the Turks, don't know quite where they moved them, and we took over their quarters, which was a little bit further up in the camp. And they weren't clean by British standards, so we have to have a good clean-up. And where they'd got newspaper on the wall to sort of cover up the... Well, I suppose I don't know, really. But anyway, they'd got newspaper on the wall. Behind this newspaper, we found little, what should I say, twists of newspaper. And in the newspaper were fingernails and toenails. And what they ever did with them, I don't know, I'm sure. But there were, you know, we found lots of them. We found lots of bedbugs too, which we never experienced, which told us that the Turks weren't nearly as clean as they could have been then. But it wasn't long before they repaired our old houses, and other prisoners went in there. I don't know who they were, because we stayed on this ex-Turkish quarter of the camp till we were released. And I can remember seeing a Korean workman. He built a house. I don't recall it having any flue under the floor, but all he'd got was basic timber, wattle lathe, straw and mud. And it was sort of an axe come mallet, and that was the only tool he used. And he made this house, well, a hut, I suppose one would term it, as opposed to a house, and it was livable in. The roof didn't leak or anything like that. They could sort of make something out of nothing. As well as the barber shop, they got more organised, and they'd set another room aside for a library, which was obviously used as a library and a reading room. And they had a carpenter shop. One of the POWs was a carpenter, Jimmy Hannaway, I think his name was. And they provided all the tools. Late in 52, I think it would have been, some of the men moved into the kitchens. Previous to this, they'd lived in the houses with the rest of us. And they'd made bunks. And presumably they'd liberated wood and built themselves these beds. And I'm not quite sure what they used for the bottom, presumably a bit of rope or something or other. But when the Chinese found out, they went mad, just the same as they'd done with the burning the sorghum for the coffee. You're using the people's wood, you mustn't do this, and all the rest of it. And all the prisoners have got to be treated the same. So down they all had to come. And then it was probably 3 weeks or a month, and they had Chinese carpenters coming round building everybody bunks. You see, again, is it the psychological thing that we're looking after you better or something like this? It seemed perhaps sometimes as though you could, if you sort of studied it a bit more, get them round to the Western way of thinking. But they went okay. Of course, I suppose they'd moved out a lot of the what we termed as reactionary blokes early on in 51, much about the same time as they moved the sergeant. So by this time, as I say, late 52, when they were making these beds, the camp was, you know, probably down by a third, I would think, to what it was in the very early days of 51. So there was more space. Inasmuch in these rooms, I wouldn't think there were many more than probably eight bunks. No, I'm sure there weren't, because the rooms were only small. You may have got six in some, but the majority had eight blokes in, whereas if you went back to early 51, you may have had many as 15 or 20 sleeping on the floor with no room at all. So, I mean, the guys had to have gone somewhere. So one can only sort of think that it was the natural thinning out, a few dying, obviously. The library, that was very popular, although it was mostly progressive books. We did have, I think, one of the first newspapers was the Shanghai Times, which was in an English edition. And then, of course, we got the London Daily Worker, again, very biased, but it was very popular. And it was, you know, one of those things that sort of kept us, again, a link with home. I don't know whether it would have made any difference if we hadn't got it, because one wouldn't have known anything, but it did give you a bit of a link. And also, we had periodicals come through, Chinese and Russian. And in one of them, China News, I can remember this was very early on, was a picture of Halmy, which was Cromwell from Cooper Force, which they'd taken. And in it, they say that they'd destroyed 30, I think it was 35 tanks or half tanks and half tracks or something like that. Well, we knew for a fact that there were only 12 there, so I mean, they do exaggerate a bit. War and Peace and Dickens and Scott, lots of all the progressive books. Ted Beckerley, he was an 8th Hussar, started maths and English lessons. And they'd given us playing cards, so there was a bridge crowd going around, and whist drives were organised and all sorts of things. Crib boards, again, always thanks to the lenient treatment policy of the Chinese People Volunteers, etc., etc. They all, I think every company, be it English or British rather, and American, even the Turks, they all had a club room with a committee to organise events, a drama group and a choir. Ours was called the Pleasant Peasants, concert party. They even had a dance group which taught modern dancing. Makes you smile. Sport, yeah, well, they encouraged sport. I can remember they we had a bit of a parade ground, and it wasn't big enough, so they made us move literally aside off of this mountain. But everybody had to help. Nobody was excused, and even the Chinese, they lent a hand as well. But all we had were these little tiny American combat shovels, which I suppose is, well, how big are they? I don't know, about a foot square or something like that. And the soil was moved by stretchers. And I can't remember how long it took, but it took a hell of a time to move this half a mountain, as we termed it. And one day they went through the main water pipe from the river through to the Korean town, Pyeongtaek. And they went bananas, these Koreans. They came down there. They were ranting and shouting, hollering at the Chinese. But I suppose it would be one of those things that happens inevitably. As the winter approached, 51-52 that is, we thought, well, are we going to have another winter like last year, which was probably inevitable? We'd been reasonably equipped for it because we'd got our tank suits, but the poor bloody infantry, they got ill-equipped for combat. And we heard afterwards that there was a lot of talk back home about the poor equipment the British Army had got in Korea. However, they say we'll give you warm winter clothing, much better than the imperialists give you, so here we go again, lads. October came, and the cold weather, and promised winter clothing. Everything was padded. You had a new issue of a shirt and your underpants, and then you had a padded coat and a padded trousers. You had a padded hat with ear flaps. You had padded gloves. I have an idea they were fingerless. And you also had a padded overcoat, and you'd got padded shoes as well, albeit them canvas with rubber soles. And then they also gave us quilted blankets, or duvets in today's language, I suppose. Again, one used to wonder whether we were going home when these things came through, you know, on a big scale sort of thing. You'd say, well, perhaps we are getting on. How are the peace talks going, etc., etc.? But of course, by this time the tank suits had gone, so we were thankful that they were warm. And they used to keep out the cold, there's no doubt about it. Are you all right? Maybe you had to use... they'd given us a couple of blankets, and I think we had to use the overcoat and the duvet on the bed to keep warm in the winter. But one managed. And I don't know where I got them from, but I got a pair of green Canadian trousers, bartering, I suppose, or something or other. They were quite distinctive because they were a nylon type, I suppose. But they'd got a lecture. And whilst they were we didn't have to go to normal lectures, they weren't compulsory. This one did. They told us everybody got to go. I'm not quite sure what they said it was about, but anyway, three or four of us, may have been others as well, said, well, we're not going. And the houses, or the town itself, lent itself to quite a bit of hide-and-seek, really. And you could sort of duck in and out. So we sort of didn't go on this. And they sent other Chinese, who we didn't know, because we had our regular guards, if you like, and English-speaking Chinese, probably three or four of them. But these other two, they came round when this lecture was on, looking for people who were behind. And this one guy, he'd got a rock in one hand and a German Luger in the other. And he saw us I suppose we were not doing anything particular. And he shouted at us, sort of thing. But we all split up and we were away. And obviously he couldn't go in four ways at once. And I don't know what happened to his mate. But several days later, I was walking along with a couple of other chaps, and this guy was there. And he recognised the trousers and he went bananas. But he didn't do anything about it. And I don't know really why, but I'll tell you another little story later. It sort of just left, I suppose. They thought, well, there's no point now, it's all over. What's the good sort of thing? Another thing we used to do, and that was count the credits, because you knew how much you were earning in the army, and obviously if you're not there to take your pay, it's all going into credit for you. And we were often used to work it out as to much. And I think I'd been in the bag now for about 18 months, and reckoned credit should have been up to about £300. I mean, that's a lot of money in those days. Quite good. But, I suppose things were left pretty well much to us. Sanitation and cleanliness was left to the men, obviously, and once we'd got organised as a British company, things did improve dramatically. The toilet pit, it obviously had to be emptied when necessary, and in the very early days there was no cover over it at all. And afterwards, though, I'm pretty sure they were Korean or Chinese, but anyway, they came round and put a proper cover over this toilet with a door either end. It was quite lush, if it's lush having dysentery. But in the winter, it still filled up, so obviously it's got to be emptied. And the only way you can empty it, if it's frozen, is with a pick and shovel. And you've got to stand on the damn stuff and pick away with your pick. Well, like if you pick ice, it chips about all over the place, and it was going in your mouth and everywhere. But you still had to do it, I suppose, and off we used to go and get in it. And in the summer, though, it was the honey bucket detail. We all used to sort of take it in turn. One squad would do it one day or one time, and then it would go round, and you each had a turn. You'd got the bucket on either end of the rope slung on a pole, a bit like one imagines Chinese, and you'd fill it up. Well, it didn't seem to matter how little you put in there, it always slopped out. And you'd go up the hill with this blessed two buckets on the pole, and it was better to sort of lope along rather than walk with a sort of swinging gait. But the damn stuff, it slopped out all over the place, and you'd empty the bucket on the hill where there were no houses, and it would just run down there. Well, of course, summertime, it was a breeding ground for flies, and I suppose, obviously, if it ran down far enough, it would go into the river and possibly come round the other side where we used to go swimming. But there we are. Talking of flies, they had a big sanitation drive one time. I suppose it was probably the summer of 52. I'm sure it wouldn't have been 51. And if you collected 20 flies, they gave you a cigarette. And for a rat, you've got a cigarette. Well, they didn't count the flies. I mean, you could get away with 18 in there, obviously, or something like that, as long as it looked reasonable. And I can recall them not even taking the blessed flies. I mean, the same flies were going around two or three times. But one got quite rich on this, with the cigarettes, of course. You see, you're back to bartering again. It was quite a good racket, that. Quite a good racket. They didn't have any washing facilities as such, but they gave us hand bowls with our scarf-like towels and the soap, and that was okay. You could do a stripped-down wash, but again, perhaps 52, they built a bathhouse down in the town. And this is, I suppose it's probably an Asian-type bathhouse, where you go in and wash all the dirt off first and then get into the communal bath. But of course, being foreign devils, we didn't know much about this, and we used to wash and not rinse off, but get into the bath with all the soap on. Well, you can imagine it got like nothing soup, didn't it? All right, if you were in the first batch, but if you were in the fourth or the fifth, well, no way would you get in there. You'd come out dirtier. So in the end, we didn't bother too much. If you could get on the first one, that was okay. But if not, you could wash down. And again, it was all right in the summer because you could go down to the river and keep clean, no trouble at all. The razor blades. Now, these were issued almost regularly, like the soap and that, but sometimes they were a bit irregular, and that caused them to go blunt. Now, again, don't know who he was or where it came from, but if you get an empty bottle, basically, they were brown bottles, so presumably they were beer bottles, I don't know. And a piece of string, which came from an unstrung string vest, which we were all issued before we went to Korea, again, something that wasn't... with a lot of the clothing, it disintegrated, obviously, with wear, but the string vest was taken off and unravelled. So you've got this piece of string. If you cross this over the bottle, one man holds the bottle, one man on either end of the piece of string, and pull it quickly, as fast as you can, and then pour cold water over it, it'll crack, clean as a whistle. I've seen this, and I've done it many, many times, and it does work. And then you get your razor blade on one finger, and work it 20 times one way, turn it over, and do it 20 times the other way, and that'll sharpen your blade for you. And that works. It's okay. It's not like a new one, obviously, but you'll get through. Sport was... That was really encouraged, all the activities. We never had any cricket, obviously, but there was no grass, let alone a bat and a ball. We had parallel bars and vaulting horse, and there were company competitions for football and that sort of thing. They used to take us down to the town, to a big school place where there was a big sort of parade area or area where they used to play basketball and that sort of thing. Whilst we still did it at our own sort of company level in the camp, this was a bigger one, and I think they used to have company football matches down there or something like that. Well, I'm not sport-minded, but one used to go down just to the freedom of getting out of the camp, really, and a bit of sort of something to do, really. It's sort of where we are. They started this sport business, and it gradually, I suppose, progressed to Olympic style. We had Camp 5 Olympics. That was about November 52. And then we had Inter-Camp Olympics. Well, I'm not quite sure of the dates there, but I know it was all held at Camp 5. And it was all done properly. They'd got an opening ceremony with a tower and reporters from each company, and they'd given cameras to the guys who were a bit camera orientated sort of thing, and they went round with the reporters taking notes from all the participants, etc., and all the rest of it. They even published a book about it all, and in the front of mine I've got all the signatures from the British POWs in Camp 5. That went down very well. And of course, you met other guys, British as well as American, from other camps on the inter-camp one. It was quite all right, that. Again, in the early days, they had no theatre. And they liked showing us propaganda films. Well,